You're never too old to be a child. A lot of my stuff is idiotic.
How do you describe marketing?
Well, can I tell you what it is not and what people think it is, or what business people think it is? It is not the coloring department.
Why did you choose to have it on the internet, PR?
Because there are 4,000 Paul Smiths in Ireland and UK alone.
How do you like Cairo?
I love it. But it took me about 10 years to come up with Sustack.
Why do I need to use it?
Saves money. It saves heart attacks as well.
Don't you get tired of being the marketing guru around the world? بي آر سميث هو من أكتر الناس المشهورة في علم الماركتينج, وأكتر حاجة هو مشهور بيها الإطار اللي عامله أو الفريمورك بتاع سوستاك. سوستاك هو إطار عالمي أو فريمورك بس للتخطيط أكتر للتسويق. بي آر سميث كتب 6 كتب لغاية النهاردة, اترجموا لـ8 لغات في العالم, وهو صاحب اختراع سوستاك البلانينج فريمورك المشهور عالميا, صنف من أحسن 3 بيزنس frameworks او business model frameworks في العالم. اتكلمنا يعني ايه ماركتينج, هو شايف الماركتينج ده بالنسبه له ايه, او التسويق عامل ازاي, وليه مهم يبقى فيه framework في حياتنا لما نيجي نشتغل, والفكره الاساسيه ما بين الشركات والافراد, يعني لما انا اعمل براندنج لنفسي هبقى عامله ازاي, ولما اعمل براندنج او ماركتينج في الاغلب لشركه هيبقى عامل ازاي, وهل الفريمورك ده يشتغل مع كله. الحلقه مفيده جدا 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 للناس العاديه, الناس اللي هي بتشتغل على السوشيال ميديا, اللي بتشتغل نفسها, نفس الوقت للناس اللي هي جزء من الديسيجن ميكرز او صانعي القرار في الشركات. الحلقه دي بالانجليزي لان طبعا بي ار سميث هو بريطاني, فانصح اي حد بيسمعنا على اي منصه سمعيه يروح على اليوتيوب ويشوفنا عليها, لان اليوتيوب فيه خاصيه ان انت تقدر تترجم الحلقه كلها للترجمه اللي انت عايزها, سواء كان اللغه العربيه او اي لغه تانية, لان ترجمه اليوتيوب ترجمه حقيقيه جدا ودقيقه لدرجه عاليه جدا. اسيبكم مع افكار بي ار سميث وان هو موجود النهارده في القاهره, وان شاء الله يكون ليها قيمه. Why is it PR Smith? So I mean I understand that your name is Paul, right?
Yes.
Why did you choose to have it on the internet, PR Smith?
Well, it's because there are 4,000 Paul Smiths in Ireland and UK alone. Across the world, I don't know, maybe 40,000 Paul Smiths. It's a common name. It's a nice name. It's a brand name used for clothes in England. Now, I'm from Ireland, and I born in Dublin, Ireland, and schooled there. But I moved to London, and I live in London now, married an English girl. And so I didn't, as it's my pen name, it's my brand, PR Smith. So there's only one, there is occasionally another PR Smith somewhere out there, very rare. But I stuck with PR Smith, and it kind of fits public relations. It's not public relations, but former communications. My actual name genuinely is Paul R. Smith. So, in fact, when we got married, there's a good one. The priest called out and he says, "Do you, Paul Smith, take this your wife? But you read the full name out." And my full name was, "Do you, Paul Russell Philip Gleason Smith, take Beverly Jean Smith as your wife?" And the whole church fell about laughing. But anyways, that's not a good brand name, Paul Russell Philip Gleason Smith. So I use PR Smith. It's simple, it's neat, it's tidy, it's different. People like it. But when I get to know them, I say, "Please call me Paul."
But I have this feeling that it's very, very important that the naming of whatever that's happening, because we are going to talk more about the marketing ideas, right? Mm-hmm. And what marketing means to people. Mm-hmm. So is the name that important?
Yeah, because it makes me stand out from different people. You know, I'm an author of a range of books about marketing and digital marketing and sportsmanship as well. So, you know, it's nice to have a book by PR Smith, not Paul Smith, because there's lots of Paul Smiths. So it is my brand. So it identifies me, and it kind of expresses a little bit about me as well. It's neat, it's tidy, it's easy to remember, it's unique, it's friendly, it works.
Yeah, I mean, but sometimes when we try to do a new brand or something, we fall in this type of rabbit hole with naming.
Yeah.
Do you think the naming criteria must have some sort of rules or something?
Well, generally brands would adhere to, you know, the common factors such as being distinctive.
Yeah.
being unique and distinctive, being easy to remember or recognize, being easy to pronounce, particularly around the world. You know, so the global brand name should be workable around the world and not mean, you know, the examples of brands meaning different things in countries that don't make sense. So you also want a brand, and in particular a logo when you get to the visual side, to be recognizable. You want people to instantly know and remember if this is that person or this brand. You want it to be recognizable from a distance in black and white, in color, in large, in small, in outdoor, sound good, sound bad. Just PR Smith comes across fairly easily. Yeah. The signature, the visual of it, it's very simple. So it's easy to remember. I mean, it's ideally brands would look for something that reflects the values of their business, of the product or service. This doesn't particularly do that. Not really. Maybe there's a subliminal thing there that it's short and neat, which is good because Sustack is short and neat and simple. So maybe it reflects a little bit about the simplicity of the system, which is good. Ideally, you want your brand to represent all of that, what's unique about your business. Not always possible to do that with visuals and audio. Or names for that matter. So far so good. You know, I've not cropped up anywhere in the world yet that where it's meant something terrible. You know, it's translated to something terrible. So far so good. It seems to work. People seem to like it and remember it.
Yeah, of course. But I feel it has a huge subliminal message, which is it's I'm talking about your name that you brand yourself with, which is PR.
Yeah,
it feels like public relations.
Yeah, I'm selling myself.
Oh, yes.
Okay, I get that. That's the downside of it.
Is it down? I feel it's a brilliant idea.
Okay, well then that's the upside.
Okay. Yeah. So, yeah. Beside frameworks and strategies and stuff like that, what can you tell me to know you more, like as a person? Who are you?
I'm a Dubliner living in London. I'm a very proud Irishman. I love London. I don't think I'll leave London. Oh, having said that, we're moving to the UAE for January. Nice. We probably repeat that each year, probably. So who am I? Well, Dubliners have their own character. You know, we're inquisitive, we're conversational. We do like to chat a lot. Maybe later on, if you want to ask me about the the Freudian analysis of Irish people, I fit with that perfectly. I can give you that later on. So who am I? I'm an adventurer. Mm-hmm. I'm inquisitive. I enjoy fun and humor. Mm-hmm. I enjoy conversation. I enjoy literature, poetry, good books, good films. I love my sport. I'm a sports junkie. Mm-hmm. I'm in my 60s, but I play football 3 times a week, 2 5-a-sides and 11-a-side on a Sunday, vets football. I had to stop rugby, sorry about that. I had to stop rugby. Just too old for rugby, but I did play a game about 6 years ago by accident. I was helping a guy out, and anyways, shouldn't have played, but I did, and it was great. I played padel. Wow. And a little bit of tennis and golf. I love all these things. So that keeps me entertained. We've got 3 kids who are adults now, spread across the world. And I've got a beautiful, wonderful wife, Beverly. We've just passed our 40th anniversary. And it's been intriguing, and she's wonderful to be with. You know, so I am lucky. I don't know how she puts up with it. A lot of my stuff is idiotic.
No, it is. It's different.
We have an expression in Ireland. You're never too. You're never too old. You're never too young. To be funny. You're never too old. That was you. You're never. Oh yeah. You're never too old to be a child.
Oh.
Now I'm one of those, and sometimes that irritates my wife because I'm just doing stupid stuff, you know. But then I do serious stuff as well, like, you know, the Sustack stuff as well. So I'd like to think of myself as a decent, fun adventurer who's kind to people as well. You know, that you can't be funny all the time. There are some times you have to be kind and careful.
Yeah, so true. I like that. I like to understand you more from different sides. But you are famous for the marketing itself and Sustack framework like in specific. And also you are famous for this, we will come to it, which is how you have this kind of vision that sportsmanship or sports in general can drive peace to the world. So, but before this, when did you stumble that in your life, or how did this happen that you found that, or you decided that marketing is going to be what you drive for somehow?
Do you know what? I've been really lucky in life. Sometimes people say you make your own luck, but I was offered my first job having graduated. I was offered my first job in a marketing department with a Belgian multinational based in Dublin before I'd even finished my degree. I was offered a job. I was interviewing marketing managers for my thesis. And this one guy enjoyed it so much. He said, would you like a job? Would you like to work with us? And my answer to him was, yeah, thanks very much. But could you wait till January? Because I want to go to Germany, actually, with my mates. And we might end up in Africa working for for a charity. And it's the first time I ever clashed with the reality of business. And he looked at me coldly. He said, the job is there 1st of October when you graduate. It is not there 1st of January. And I've never been hit between the eyes like before. And I thought for about 30 seconds. I thought, don't look a gift horse in the... Is that an expression here? Don't look a gift horse in the face. I never understood what it means. Don't look a gift horse in the face. But my mother used to say it. I thought, say yes. So I did. Anyways, it was a marketing department in fluorescent lighting was the business. So it doesn't get much more boring a product than fluorescent lighting. But my marketing manager, Aidan Brophy, was brilliant. He was just amazing to work for, fantastic guy. And I thoroughly enjoyed working with him. So I kind of fell into marketing. I wasn't even that interested in marketing, even though I did a thesis on it. My first degree was business and management. So it was more finance and accounting. Nobody that I know went on to marketing, no one except me. So I kind of fell into the job. I did find it a little bit more interesting than finance and accounts. So hence I did my thesis on it and then met this marketing director who offered me a job. Funny story for you. So he takes me out for dinner or lunch. And he didn't live too far away from me in Dublin. And so I said, yeah, great, we'll meet you. And my car was broken down at the time. So I borrowed my father's car, who wasn't around at the time. I'll just say he was away at the time. And the side door, the door didn't open on the driver's. A truck had hit his car and the door didn't open. The window did, but the door didn't. And something had happened to the ignition. So you couldn't use the key. So the only way to start the car was to roll it down a hill, jump in the car. After pushing the car, you have to run around the far side where the door did open, or you could dive through the window, grapple, get up, hold the steering wheel, kick it into first gear, second gear, let off the clutch, and I go da-dung, da-dung, brrrr, and off you go. I drove over there to the lunch. This guy doesn't know this, right? I parked the car well away from the restaurant, go up, meet him. We have a great deal. It's like the final check. You know, is this guy, do we give him a written contract now? So we have a great lunch and he says, okay, he says, you start on the 1st of October. Congratulations, you got the job. I said, that's great. Thanks very much. He said, now, do you want to lift home? I said, no, I've got the car. Thanks. He said, okay, I'll walk you down to your car. I said, no, you don't have to. He said, no, I will. And the more I said, no, please, you don't have to, he realized something was going on. So we got to the car and I turned around and shook his hand and said, thanks, I really enjoyed the lunch. I look forward to seeing you the 1st of October. And he stood there. He wouldn't go away. And I said, well, I'll walk you back to your car. And at that stage, he's looking at me, says, Smithy, get in your car. I said, yeah, I will, but bye. He still stood there. So I thought, oh my God, I'm going to lose this job. So I went around the car. I'd leant in through the window, let off the handbrake.
Yeah.
Steered it, pushed, and I parked it on a hill, so it'd be easy to do this. Turned it over, and then I had to run around behind it as the car rolled down on its own. I ran behind the car and opened the door on the other side, jumped in, put it into second gear, and I went to do, to do, to, and gave him a wave.
Wow, he saw the whole thing.
He saw the whole thing. Oh, I worked for him for 4 years. We've gone so well. In fact, I lost touch with him over the years. It's 40 years ago. But I knew someone who knew him. And I said, is he still alive? He said, yeah. I said, give me his address. I'd love to send him a Christmas card just to say that I'll never forget working with him. He was great. And I knew it would be important to him. And I sent him photographs of what I look like now, which is different to 40 years ago. And I told him what I've done with my life and all the rest of it. And he got it and he sent me a card back. It was lovely. And then I said, I'll visit you next time in Dublin. But I didn't have his number. I found his house. I banged on the door, but he wasn't there.
Yeah.
So I wrote a note, put it through the door, and he did send me a message. So I will see him soon. He's getting very old now, but a lovely man. And when he said to me, 2 years into the job, came to the review at Christmas time, and he said, okay, Smithy, you've got a choice of three options. One, stay doing the same job, selling fluorescent lights in the marketing fluorescent lights in the Irish market. Two is move into engineering in the Irish market and repeat what you're doing there, or go to London where we're setting up a new sales and distribution depot and you get a car with expenses. And he hadn't even finished the sentence, car with expenses, London, I'm in. So that was how we moved to London, fell in love with this gorgeous girl. And I like music a lot. I actually didn't say that. I love music, live music in particular. And, you know, it's dangerous in London because there's so much good music. You could go out every night. You become an alcoholic, you know. So I was conscious of this because my father was an alcoholic. And so I was conscious of this and thought, I must sign up for some evening courses. And in London, you can study anything. It's fantastic, the variety of stuff in London. There's a book that size, it comes out every year with courses that you can take. So I took a postgraduate diploma in finance. I wasn't even interested in it, but I knew it was better being in a class than being in a pub, you know, just to vary it. And then after that, I said, I'll do a master's part-time as well, just to keep me off the streets. And I did that. And then I broke out. I left the multinational. I started doing my own teaching and a bit of consultancy. You know, I sold Christmas crackers in America to pay for my MBA. They don't have Christmas crackers there. So that was a really fun, that was fun. I dealt with the biggest of the chains in America. That was fascinating. And I drove around my little motorbike in London. In fact, I had one gig where I did some teaching in Woolwich, which is 17 miles on the other side of London. It's a long trip on my little motorbike. It was so cold in the winter that my hands would be locked. I couldn't take them off. I eventually had to get one off and then knock the other ones off. I couldn't get my keys. Like for half an hour, I couldn't get into my house. It was so cold. My hands wouldn't work, you know. But they were great days. Yeah.
Wow. I love that. I can't even go to the next question. With your experience somehow, and I feel that you have different type of experiences, but actually more adventurous than I thought of. How did you describe marketing?
How would I describe marketing?
Yes.
Well, can I tell you what it is not and what people think it is, or what business people think it is? It is not the coloring department. In fact, a few people said this to me today, really interesting comments, that other business people just don't care what marketing people say. You know, it's not that important. We want to do it this way, we'll do it this way. You know, it's not your decision, marketing. So it's pity to see that, because the companies that embrace marketing tend to do better than those that don't. Or some companies don't realize they're doing marketing, but they are. They're taking care of the customers superbly and doing everything right without being trained marketers. That's rare, but it does happen. You know, where there's a customer-centric culture, that can happen just naturally. It's lovely to see it happen. But what is marketing? Well, one of the official definitions of it, which is kind of an interest from the Chartered Institute of Marketing, the biggest institute of marketing in the world, is marketing is the management profession of identifying, anticipating, and satisfying customer needs profitably. Now, you should replace that word profitably with efficiently or effectively. Not-for-profits can fit into that definition. That's a definition of it. It's not a bad one. It's understanding customers and developing relationships with lifetime relationships with them. That's what I would say it's about, really. There are lots of new tools that weren't around 10 or 20 years ago, particularly with AI. That can be very helpful, but they can also be quite dangerous and damaging to your brand. AI, there's pluses and there's minuses to AI. So marketing is really reinforces itself by the belief of purpose of your business. So back to your mission statements. You know, why do you have a business? What is the purpose of your business? And it has to be, and if it's not, it's not marketing, and it's probably not going to succeed in the longer term. It is your purpose, your raison d'etre. Why do you have a reason to exist as a business? And those that say, oh, to sell more products, are wrong. And they won't last long in this new era of hyper competition. So it's about really, it's about helping customers and ultimately helping society in a sense. And there are those purposeful companies that know that, realize that, that their purpose is to help customers have a better time, B2B or B2C, it doesn't matter, are the ones that are more customer orientated and will have a better chance of surviving. And they will probably say, yeah, we need some marketing here.
So you mean marketing is a little bit of a value-driven application of the company somehow?
It's a series of management processes.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's a discipline. It is creative, but it's scientific. It's drawing increasingly on scientific as well to be professional about it. Probably the biggest driver is the art. It embraces the art of asking great questions. And that drives really good it drives really good business, period. But it drives really good marketing if you're asking really good questions.
Yeah, but what's the difference between marketing and branding, for instance?
Branding's part of marketing.
Okay. So branding is an activity somehow in marketing.
Yeah, it's a process. One of the marketing processes, yeah.
Okay. Because I always
An ongoing process.
Ongoing, yeah.
Forever going on, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I would take this guess. Did you see the rebranding of Jaguar, for instance?
Yeah.
What do you think about it?
Not for me, but I'm an old fart.
Okay.
So it could be a young generation thinks that's the coolest thing. Now, they can't buy Jaguars, but remember, a lot of advertising is creating aspirations.
Hmm.
You know, it's not looking for a quick sell. In fact, a lot of advertising wants to separate those that have and those that haven't, those that aspire towards that brand but will never have it. That's part of what makes that aspirational brand more valuable, that some can afford it, others can't. So the brand is enhanced by that. Now, I'm not convinced with this particular campaign. I've only seen one clip of it, and it didn't do it for me. But as I say, I'm an old fart. I'm not the target audience. Now, it could be they're going to diverse Jaguar into really alternative younger people's products, you know, scooters and who knows what. Maybe it's softening people up for that. I mean, it has generated a lot of comment, mostly negative. So the jury's out with me just at the moment because I want to see some more of it before I make a decision about what I really think about it. But I do think we need to think about maybe there's more than just trying to sell a Jaguar car to, you know, I don't know what the profile is. Is it 45 to 55-year-old, 35 to 55-year-old, high-income professional person? I don't know what the profile is, but if it was that, it doesn't seem to be meeting that marketplace. But maybe there's other things they haven't handled but that we don't know about.
Yeah, but I mean they already made this kind of advertising, this kind of public idea that, oh, Jaguar is there. When I think about the rebranding of Jaguar, I also always link it with this guy who brought the banana with the strap on it.
Oh yeah,
yeah, for 6 million grand,
yeah.
Because he wanted to do this as an advertising key somehow, advertising aspect, for his company. So
I didn't know that. Is that's his purpose?
Yeah, he had a company that was selling, I think, cryptocurrency something.
Okay,
and he had this kind of a tweet. He made a tweet saying that I spent 6 million to advertise my company, and it's much much more cheaper to buy this banana and eat it.
Wow!
He
got 6 million worth of press coverage from
exactly.
It. Wow. Well, fair play to him.
Yeah.
I'd heard he'd eaten it. I thought, what an egotistical guy that is. But I didn't know all the information. So never jump to a conclusion, as the fellow says, you know. That's interesting. Yeah.
I mean, sorry for the, stopping. But I mean, sometimes I feel that there are some plays that you can do with marketing or advertising or a strategic marketing activity that could lead to a bigger business benefit.
Yeah.
But from the outside, you don't see it a little bit right now. But by time, you would figure out, oh, wow, they won.
I'll give you two examples of that. One is, I think it was like 1920s in America. The biggest PR guy, his name eludes me right now. But he got himself arrested. He punched a policeman in the face and got himself arrested. And he had a high profile. So all the press were queuing up when he came out. And they all want to know, why did you punch the policeman in the face? And he said, his answer was, because he wouldn't let me finish my O'Reilly's blueberry cake, which is my favorite. Of course, that went on TV. Oh, O'Reilly's blueberry cake must be pretty good. And the coverage you got from it was ridiculous. But here's an even better one. It's more recent. And I've had the privilege of making contact with the artist.
Wow.
Have you heard of Banksy?
Banksy?
Yeah, Banksy. No, what's that? He's the biggest name in England. I thought it'd be bigger over here. Banksy is a street artist. He does graffiti at night. Mm-hmm. And you wake up in the morning and somewhere in London or around England, there's a beautiful Banksy painting. And he only works in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. Now, they're so valuable, these things, that people will cut the whole brick off and steal it. So sometimes now, if there's a Banksy somewhere, they put up grids and protect it and put lights on it and security and stuff, because Banksy's artwork is phenomenal. Now, he's a very, very cool guy. He has set up a Banksy hotel on the Palestinian Wall, right? That separates Israel from Palestine. There's a hotel there, and it's the money that's made there from all his merchandise. So all his paintings are put onto T-shirts and books and so on. And all the revenues from that goes to support the people of Palestine. That's Banksy. Now, this is the really cool bit of the story. I've always liked his work, and I've always thought I'd love to get it into one of my books. Partly because I believe you have to edutain people, you know, so you can teach people about marketing. But it's nice to entertain them while you tell them. So tell me an interesting story as well. I thought Banksy is an interesting one. I wonder one day, can I somehow get him in there? Did you find him?
Yeah.
His stuff's amazing.
Yeah.
So here's what happened to a Banksy painting that was on a canvas and framed. Now, I don't know that bit of the story, how that happened, but it was on a canvas and framed in a wooden frame. And it went to Sotheby's, you know, the best auction house in London, Sotheby's. And it sold for, I can't remember, was it 1.3 million? I'm not sure of the numbers. But so, and it's sitting there on a frame. And as the guy goes, you know, give it 1.1 million, 1.1, 1.2 million, 1.3 million. Anybody else going for 1.3 million? Bang, you know, sold for 1.3 million. And everybody claps. And as that happened, on the wall, the Banksy starts to move out of the frame.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Into a shredder.
Yeah.
And it shredded half of itself when it stopped. So it was preset with a shredder. It was done like, I don't know, a year or two earlier maybe. I think the value of it went up twice, but certainly the publicity it got.
Exactly.
So I thought, I've got to put this in my book, because that's a great publicity story. In the PR chapter, that's a big feature, that story. So I went after Banksy. I found him through Instagram. Very hard to track down. I don't know if it's him, her, they, who, what we're dealing with here. No one knows. But I got legal permission to use that, as long as it wasn't used on the front cover. That was the only thing they insisted on. And it's declared as copyright, etc. And I respected that and did that and made a donation. Didn't even ask for a donation towards the cause, made a donation. And I would love, if I went to Palestine, I would love to see that hotel and stay there and support what he's trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, so...
So that's self-destructive art, as you were talking about the banana story.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, do you believe in such a thing that is what they call, there is no bad publicity?
No, I don't agree with that at all.
You don't agree?
No, okay. No, that's stupid.
Okay.
There is bad publicity, believe me. I'll give you an example. What was the guy's name? He's a jeweler. He's developed a jewelry chain in London, expanded to England, then became so big that he started buying jewelry chains in America. Mm-hmm. Within a matter of years, he was the biggest jewelry chain in the world. Now, he specialized in downmarket, cheap, tacky stuff. And he was very proud of that fact. And in all his press releases, he told that. And he just got too smart and too casual and too abusive of his own company, you know, of his own brand, of his own product, of his own staff. He one day said, and this is what killed him off. His name will come to me in a second. It killed him off. If you Google at the same time, you'll probably find it. Jewelry, biggest jeweler collapse in the UK. It's not Hanson's, his name like that will come to me. So he, at a press interview, he said, you know, we sell cheap jewelry. It's so cheap. He said, you could pay more for a chicken sandwich than you would for one of our silver rings. Oh. Right? So you say, how cheap this is. He's saying, we're the cheapest, this cheap, cheap, cheap. And he kind of ended up insulting his own brand, insulting his own staff that we're all cheap, his product's cheap. And he just said it one time too many that people went, you're a cheap so-and-so. Your stuff is really tacky cheap. And his business collapsed. He now runs a couple of gym clubs. That's it. His name will come to me before the end of the thing.
I'm trying to find it.
Yeah, it would be 1990s, Hanson Jewelry. But English jewelry chain collapses. If you put that in there, it might come
but,
up.
But why would he say such a thing?
He was greedy for publicity.
Ah, okay, so he wanted to have something that is
shocking.
Yeah, shocking to go viral somehow.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, so it doesn't always pay any publicity. It's good publicity. You know, look at the Jaguar. That could be very damaging. We will know in 2 years' time, you know, if it's really seriously damaged the brand or not. So no, it's not true to say any publicity is good publicity.
But from the other side, when you see people that are using the social media, which we call them right now influencers, they do whatever they can for publicity. They do whatever they want for whatever that makes them go more viral.
Yeah, they do. And there may come a point when they get too casual and they just go one step too far, just like the jeweler. Mm. It can happen. I mean, there is a influencer chef in England at the moment who's about to lose his whole everything. I don't know if he did it as PR, but he just... It became too casual. He dropped his guard. So on a cooking show, he ate this pie that was cooked and they comment on it. And he said something like, that's so good. I could smash your tarts or something like that to the lady chef that built it. People went, what? What did he just say? Now, maybe he didn't mean it. Maybe it was unconsciously really what he's about. But everybody said, no, you can't say that. You could have been referring to the lady that made it or other ladies. You know, and tart is an expression which means a girl who throws herself about a bit. Mm. There's all sorts of implications. Now, it could be innocent, genuine mistake, or it could be the kind of person he is. They're not forgiving him. He's going to lose. They've already suspended the television programs on TV for him. So that's gone. Probably his contract's gone. And he's a big influencer. He was one of these television chefs.
But how can you control it? Or, I mean, where is the line between bad and good publicity? Think it the other way. Where is the line between I want to make something viral and that doesn't harm me?
Wow, I don't know. Let me think. I think I was going to say you cannot say sexist things. Mm-hmm. You cannot say racist things. But you look at some of the leaders around the world and they are racist and sexist. Yeah. And you know what I'm talking about. Yeah, yeah. And they've gotten away with it because the market's changed and it seems to be some people support them. So it depends in the country you're in, the market you're in, the culture you're in. I mean, in this country, there's lots of things you could say that would have you locked up or would have never allowed to go on television again.
Yeah, yeah.
So there is a line between just publicity and publicity for any sake to do anything for anyone. So, you know, couldn't make any religious comments, could you really? You know, so there's a line there. And in some countries more than other. So I guess it's a cultural thing that you sensitive to and do your homework and respect the culture to a certain degree.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's left to every individual somehow. And it's left also to where are you talking or to whom.
Yeah.
So I want to go to the famous Sostak idea. Mm-hmm. And I want you to explain what stand for the Sostak, so strategy and stuff like that. And also, I would like to know why did you put a framework or make a framework that people in the business to understand somehow? What's the purpose of it?
Okay, it was created out of rage and frustration.
Wow.
With nice plans.
Okay.
So when I was doing my master's, in what was then City University, the Sir John Cass Business School, which mm-hmm. is very highly rated. It's now changed its name, but it was a very good master's program. And when I got to doing the marketing module, I was looking at plans and discussing plans and these with textbooks this thick, about plans. Really difficult to understand or remember the structure. You know, you close the book, you think, if I did that, could I do it without the book? I couldn't. It's just like, what was the way? What's the structure of this thing? Very difficult. So I was very frustrated with trying to figure out, plan, how to learn to write a plan. And I couldn't get it from books. And I was searched, couldn't get it. So I was doing a 2-year part-time. Excuse me. And I asked all my colleagues when they got their first job and wrote the first plan, would they send me a copy of it, just the contents page, nothing else, so I could study the way they structured the things. And over 2 years, lots did. And that was gold dust to me because I really thought hard, looked hard. But it took me about 10 years to come up with Sustack. It was 10 years after I graduated because I tried lots of different ones. And eventually, I had Sustackle and people liked that. It was nearly there, but it wasn't quite there. But when I came up with Sustack, the reaction I knew was special because the reaction for the first two groups of people I introduced it to, they went ballistic. One was IBM in Brussels. Mm-hmm. And these are middle managers, serious people. And I introduced it there. And the course organizer was sitting in watching the whole program. And when I explained it to them in 3 minutes, he came up and said, Paul, I have to interrupt you. He said, did you all hear what this guy's just said to you? He said, use this for the rest of your life. It's brilliant. Where'd you get it, Paul? I said, well, I've been working on it for many years. This is it. I'm glad you like it. And then he started getting them to chant S-O-S-T-A-C. I mean, that was embarrassing. I wasn't comfortable with that. But then I took it to Luxembourg to actually an ex-IBMer that I'd worked with there. And I worked with him in all the companies he's gone with ever since, Fortune 500 companies. And his own company now called CleverTouch, who are kind of the leaders in automated marketing now, AI marketing, really good company in England. And he ran up to me when I introduced it to his group over 3 minutes. And he said, Paul, at the coffee break, he said, have you protected this? Have you registered it? I said, no, please take an hour off, go and do it. I said, okay. So I did. I registered and protected it as a trademark. It's in the public domain now. So, people can use it, mm-hmm. but they can't sell it per se because it's a trademark. Yeah. So yeah, I was born out of rage and frustration, and I'm still refining it. It's gone. The book, The Sustack Guide to Your Perfect Digital, it's now a digital marketing plan. It's in, I think it's the 11th edition. So the 2025 edition, which is the AI edition, is coming out. I finished it. I'm just going to push a few buttons when I get back. It'll take me about a day to load it up and the final little tidy up things. So it'll be out probably a week from now or 10 days, middle of December for the 2025 launch. And I've got our first public Sustack Masterclass in London on the 30th of January, a public one. Usually I do it for clients and corporations, or in this case, it's working with the team in Nexus, and they do all the marketing and promote and set it up and run it, and I just come into town and do my thing, and that's very nice. I like it that way as well. The book is updated, and I update it every year. So every year it's getting better. I'm taking the difficult stuff is taking out stuff. That's hard to do, but I got to keep doing it. I'm very pleased with it. It's definitely the best Sustack book yet.
Oh, nice. But so what does it stand for? So Sustack.
Okay. So S-O-S-T-A-C. S is for situation analysis. Where are you now? Objectives is where do you want to go? Strategy is how do you get there? Tactics are the details of strategy, the marketing mix. Actions are how do you ensure excellent execution of those tactics by your staff? And that bit's not in many plans. It's missing, and it's why a lot of plans fail. And C is for control, metrics. What are you going to measure to find out if you're getting there? You don't want to wait until the end of the year to find out whether it worked or not. So, some once a day, once a week, once a month, once a quarter, those things you need to be checking and controlling and staying on top. And that links back to the objectives that you set. Are you hitting? Are you matching those? And if not, then you change things. So, you can put it into a 90-day loop. So Sustack's very simple. Where are you now? Where are you going? How do we get there? That's the SOS. Tactics is the details of strategy, the marketing mix, the 7 Ps, all that. Actions is internal marketing. How do you train, motivate, communicate your team to carry out this clever plan. And C is for control the metrics. List the metrics you're going to measure. Some of them will cost you money, like surveys or sentiment analysis. You pay a few thousand for those. The others are free. So list which ones cost money, who's going to do it, when they present it, and what do you do when you have a blip and you recognize a blip. You know, so that's being in control. And it includes usability testing of your website and common sense stuff that you test. Test your chatbots. Do not take any bots on without testing them every day, checking them. It's that important. You know, Microsoft released a chatbot in 2016. Tay was its name. And within 24 hours, it went racist.
Oh, wow.
Praising Hitler. And people were taking the mickey out of it. They were kind of prompting it and saying things to it and this, that, and the other. And so fortunately, they were watching it. And within 24 hours, it had turned racist. And they cut the plug, they pulled it. Now, I've put a bot on my website, prsmith.org. I had to take it down after the first month because people were just saying, what is Sustack? And you give it an answer, and they say, okay, so what's situation analysis? And it gives you an answer. Okay, and what's in customer analysis? And it gives you another. They were just kind of getting a book written for them and filing it somewhere. And that wasn't doing anybody, but it certainly wasn't helping them as much as I could, and it wasn't helping me. So it was drawing data from the internet, a lot of which is wrong about Sustack. So for example, I discovered today, somebody told me today that if you put into the Google bot, the AI, it will, if you say, what is Sustack? It comes out Gemini. It will say it's a planning framework that does this, this, and this. It's not very good for strategy, and it's got some gray areas elsewhere. And it gives wrong information now, absolutely wrong.
Wow.
Now, I'm going to fix that when I go back, absolutely, but onto that like a shot. But it's a good example of the dangers of your Sustack being destroyed.
Yeah, I mean, I understand. But I'm really interested in how does it work? So what's the difference between Sustack and maybe different type of management frameworks?
Yeah. The other ones are difficult to remember, in my opinion. There's one that somebody has told, who is it brought this one out? It's like Justic. But one of the letters is different to situation analysis, but the others, they cover pretty much my stuff. But they've, can I say this? Probably can't. But I can say that I had a very kind offer today from another author, who said, we use a planning system that's not as good as this. May we include yours in the book? And I said, absolutely, I'll write it for you if you want. So that was really nice. He said, it's just better. There's another one called Race. And a lot of people think Race, and actually some of these chatbots will suggest Race is better. It's not. I mean, I know the guy that created Race. He's a friend of mine. I co-authored a book with him, actually, and he agrees with me, you know, that Race fits into tactics. You know, it doesn't cover a whole plan. It's not comprehensive. Yet you'll get people debating which is the better framework. There's no comparison. Race is useful as within tactics. That's about it, really. It's not a comprehensive plan. So Sustack is comprehensive. It's different to the others. And two things I'd say make it unique. One is, it builds, it's an insistence on intelligence and information-driven decisions. So you ask all the right questions in the situation analysis. During that, actually answers and solutions will jump out. Strategy becomes quite easy when you do really deep situation analysis. So it's information-driven and intelligence-driven decisions, number one. Number two, it separates strategy from tactics. A lot of things I see have no idea of the difference between the two. And thirdly, it delivers a reassuring sense of order in a chaotic digital and AI world that we live in today.
Yeah, I mean, if I try to like apply it for myself, what I use when I work, I use the design thinking methodology, for an instance.
Use which?
Design thinking methodology.
Yeah.
And then I try to measure it somehow with OKRs or KPIs. So I mix both of these together, and I try to have like a mixture of creative ideas and that are measurable somehow. And if I want to maybe make it more agile, I try sprints. So like the sprint model.
Yep.
So when do I need to use a stack, for an instance, and why do I need to use it?
Okay. It stops firefighting is one thing. By having a plan, it does stop firefighting. You know, so you're not always just reacting and reacting, right? It saves money if you plan. Because you know, if you buy stuff in advance, if you know you're going to need this, you can negotiate much better terms than if it's firefighting and oh, I need this yesterday, you get screwed. So it saves money. It gives an overall direction for people to know what their purpose for the company is. It sorts that out. It gives kind of a reason, a purpose. Gives everybody a purpose. That's good for morale. It saves money. You make better decisions. Because you have time to get the answers to the questions. So if you're doing customer analysis, there's three big questions: who, why, how. And if you can't answer those three questions in depth, and by in depth I say there's another 10 questions spinning off each one of those, but who is my ideal customer is a huge question. Why do they buy or not buy? Why do they visit my website but not a second time? Why? How do they buy? Morning, evening, online, offline, which sites and so on. So if you get the answers to those, you're taking the risk out of your business because you're making more intelligent decisions. So it saves money. It saves heart attacks as well. Pressure and stress. Like, oh my God, you know, this is just happening. Yeah. You know, you've planned for it 6 months in advance. You know, you've got the content ready. You've got the stuff ready. Life gets easier. So no heart attacks. Good for your health to have a plan. It's more cost effective. And it's more successful overall because you make better, more intelligent decisions.
Yeah, I like that. Can you have a situation? Like, can we try to apply the model maybe on the Glassroom podcast? What do you think?
Yeah.
Okay. So what do I need now? Like, what do I need to start with the S?
Yeah, situation analysis. Okay.
Okay.
So, partially, you know, you could say, well, last year our objective was to reach 1 million people or something.
Okay.
Right. So it's nice to bring in a little bit of an objective and say, well, you know, so we're roughly going to try and reach 1.5 million or 2 million this year or whatever. Okay. So let's go back to situation analysis. What have we got? So who's your audience out there?
So my audience, maybe the people above 18 years old, maybe starts from 20 to, I think, late 30s, I think. And people that are, that want to have valuable information that they can listen to and want to seeking to see role models that they can follow somehow. So these kind of people.
Okay. There's a lot of those, and some of them might be more interested than others. Some will bite your hand off saying, this is just what I need. So there's work to be done still in the situation analysis, in the customer analysis. Who are the ones that will bite your hand off for that just love this stuff and say nice things about it and become advocates? They're different to the ones that might listen to you once and never again. I don't know what the difference is. You don't know, but that is a job to be done. Yes. There's your customer analysis. And now you know, because you're building a plan for 3 months down the road or 6 or 9 months, now you know I've got to find that information out. And boy, will I make a better decision about how I'm going to reach them, because now I know who I'm looking for, right? So who is, it's probably the hardest question. It's the weakest question, actually, for a lot of companies, is who is their ideal. I struggle with it with Sustack itself. Yes. So then the who, the why, the how, and all those sub-questions. And you go off and you become immersed in knowing your customers better than they know themselves. Mm. Why do people, they don't even know why they enjoy your stuff, but you've got to know why they might enjoy it.
Yeah.
And that's what you build your business on. So that's just the customer bit. Then are you competing with anybody? Who are your competitors? Okay. The competitors might be podcasters, but it might also be Netflix.
Yeah.
And it might also be sleep. You know, Netflix says sleep is one of the competitors. The main competitor is sleep. That's what they say. Now, I'm not sure you're competing with sleep. Well, there's only enough hours in a day, so it may be an issue. It is a possibility. So who are your competitors? Who gets in the way? Who doesn't? Who can you reach that might be using your competitors that you could do better with your stuff? So company analysis, your products, what's the strengths and weaknesses that you think you have, what's unique about you, all that kind of stuff. So you spend time answering these questions, and we list all these questions in the book or on the courses. And you go through all those, and over time, you'll find places where you get quick answers. Mm-hmm. So maybe if you invite dialogue and you start getting a lot of dialogue back, you could feed that into a chatbot and then say, what are the common things that are coming out of this? Are the common needs, or the common patterns, or the common things people like here? And you might learn, and you know, where are these people coming from? You know, are they male, are they female? What age are they? Can you get that data? And if you decide you want that data, you will find a way of getting it legally, generally speaking. So you get more information, and then you can do better targeting. So your situation, the donkey work has to be done. It'll then say, right, we want to hit 2 million or 1.5 million next year. So how are we going to do that? What's the strategy for it? Well, what have we done till now, up to now? How did that work? Did some things work better than others? Should we do more of that? Yeah, probably. And less of the stuff that doesn't? Yeah, probably. You can't do everything. So part of strategy would be say, well, how do you want to position this? You want to tell people that this is a bit of a different podcast. It's more than just straight tell us about who you are, why you're great, and so on. It's a bit of a psychological insight into the people behind things, or, you know, find how you want to be positioned is different to all the other ones that are out there. And I think you are. I'm sensing this from this conversation already, and I'm enjoying it thoroughly, by the way. It's intriguing. So to position yourself and be very clear about what position you want to have in people's mind, and not be accidental, or, you know, be clear. And then you can repeat that in everything you do. So you embed that position. The more you embed it, the more stronger you get. And the stronger you are, the more people recognize you, see you, identify you, as opposed to being a bit of this, a bit of that, a bit of the other. You're fragmented and you're weak. Be positioned strongly as A and B rather than X, Y, Z and 1, 2, 3. So there's a bit of work to be done there on positioning. Decide who exactly how you want people to see your stuff on two axes, no more. This is strategy now. So that is strategic. Target markets, who is your target market? That is strategic. Mm-hmm. You may say, I'm going to choose A, B, and C, and I'm going to stop going after D and E because they don't stay with us. They're only one-offs sort of thing. So that's strategic, to make that choice. Mm-hmm. That is strategic. Positioning is as well. Maybe partnerships. You know, I do a list of things called Top Seed, TOPPPSWED. I won't go through them all with you, but I ask people to consider all of these components, so they can then start to write a good strategy. So TOP would be targeting, which target markets. P would be positioning. O would be objectives. What you remind yourself what you're trying to achieve with your strategy. But the next P is partnerships. Other partnerships that could help you double your audience. I bet there are. I bet there are. And when you look at partnerships, for me, you're looking at potential partners that are targeting your ideal customer, not your average customer or not your lousy customer, your ideal customer. You're after them and they're targeting them as well. And by the two of you coming together, 2 + 2 = 5, if you can get that. So it's like an airline. An airline offers you flights. Yes, thanks very much. But they also offer you hotels and cars. A lot of people need that. That's useful. It's helpful. It's a good partnership. So they pay a percentage to each other for every bit of business they get. It's a no-brainer. It's an alliance, an affiliate alliance, really. So that's just one of many types of partnerships that you could have. You could have sponsorship partnership, and getting access to your sponsor's audience might be very nice. I mean, you could get 10 times your audience with the right sponsor if they really like your stuff. But, you know, you've only got so many hours in the day to target these people. But, you know, that brings you back to who you're going to target for funding to grow your business or to get to. I always say one good partner could do all of your marketing. If you piggyback the right partner, now you have to be a bit weary. Sometimes you pick a partner and they like the partnership so much, they say, well, we'll go into this business. I've got a very good friend in Dublin who does electric beds. And I said, listen, I found a guy who's a CEO of a national chain of nursing homes. Perfect. And I said, I've told him a little bit about your business. Do you want me to introduce you to him? You know, I thought I was doing him the biggest favor of his life. Now he's been ripped off twice. He's a very good friend of mine. And he thought about it very hard and he said, you know what, if it becomes really successful, it's a logical step for this guy to say, you know, I don't need you, I can get these myself. And so sometimes partnerships, things do go wrong. The devil's in the detail. It is a partnership, it is a marriage. You know, you've got to work hard at it. You can't just sign a contract and that's it. There's a lot of work to be done to manage partnerships. But I suspect, I'm pretty confident saying this to you now, that a good partner could, you know, elevate you to whatever level you want. And I know you don't want to conquer the world.
Yeah.
But, you know, it depends on your objectives. So the question was, how could Sustack help you? So I'm recommending that you don't have to do a situation analysis in one go. Just be familiar with what the questions are. So that sometimes you'll stumble over things that, oh, look, there's an analysis already done about my marketplace by the Financial Times, about everything about podcasts across Europe that you'd ever need to know. So once a year, you pay your £2 and you've got the analysis of the marketplace. You summarize it down. You might get feedback in AI coming through to give you customer information and all that. But if I may just jump in with one thing in the middle of this, is how to make the perfect decision. So you're trying to make a strategic decision. So you've done your analysis, situation analysis. You know what your objectives are. You're in your strategy and you're not sure to go for A or B. Or when you go to tactics, you're not sure to do A, B, C, D, or E, you know. So how do you make a really good decision? And there's an art in making good decisions, in my opinion. Again, I've not read this anywhere. It's just, you know, observations and thinking about it. And I see 5 steps. Some will argue there's a lot more. But for me, if you want to make a really good decision, is number one is define the opportunity or the problem. Mm. Number two, define what information you need to make a great decision. Number three, get the information. Number four, digest the information. And number five, decide. Now, I'm going to ask you, which of those 5 is the most, is the one that people don't do? So number one, define the problem or opportunity. Number two, define what information you need. Number three, get the info. 4, digest the info. 5, decide. Which is the weakest one of those 5 bits of the process of making great decisions?
I think the first.
No.
No.
So I'm going to give you a second chance now.
Okay.
Which of the 4?
Okay, this is hard.
Maybe. So first again was define the opportunity, define it clearly, the opportunity or the threat or the problem.
Okay.
2, decide what information you need. 3, get the info. 4, digest the info. 5, decide.
Maybe digest?
That is number 4, and that's wrong as well.
Okay.
So this proves that people try to make decisions without really having a good way of making decisions. Mm. So this is... It's a bit bold for me to say the perfect way. There's probably a better way, but it's a darn good way. Shall I take you out of your misery rather than ask you to go again?
Please.
Okay.
Please.
As he's banging his head on the table against the wall. Let me out of here.
Here's a hell of a moment. What's the answer?
Can I go up against the wall?
Yeah, of course. Oh, my God.
It is the second one. Define what information you need to make a great decision.
So what you need to make a great decision. So asking the right question.
Maybe. Yeah.
So, that's what I thought of defining the problem. Because there is this kind of like framework also, which is defining the, it's called a problem statement. So before you do anything, you need to define what's the problem. Mm. And then you put it in a statement so you can understand actually what are you facing and start to have solutions or start to, I don't know, mitigate somehow.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why I went with the first one.
That overlaps, it overlaps. But I like to keep it as very separate and think very hard. So this is something I used to do. I must do it again, actually, in my masterclasses workshops. I used to take 4 cards or just write 4 cards on a board. But I'll do it with the cards. And one of them is an ace. And I put them face down on the table. And I say, I show everybody, look, there's an ace in here. And then I shuffle it and I put them down the table. And I said, now, would any of you like to bet £10 against my £10? And I put £10 down the table. And I say, are there any gamblers in the room? And usually there's one or two. And I say, yeah. I say, okay, put £10 down. And if you get it right, if you find the ace, you win £10. And suddenly people go, what? That's not a very good deal. Like a 1 in 4 chance for... an equal return. No, if I said to them, I'll give you £40 if you get the right, that's fair because there's a 1 in 4 chance of getting it, right?
Yeah.
So regardless, they usually suss me out pretty quickly and I say, okay. And I put £40 on and I say, here's a bonus, £50 on the table. Pick anybody want to pick the ace. Now I prime somebody in the audience to when I'm walking around the room talking, that he leans across and he picks up one of the cards and he shows it to everybody, right? And I don't know this, or I'm pretending I don't know this, right? So everybody's trying to, you know, pretend not to giggle. And I'm saying, come on, there must be somebody who's prepared. And sometimes there's a gambler there who say, yeah, I'll put a tenner on it. And then I say, okay, very good. And then I walk around the room, and behind my back, the guy picks up a second card. Now, I've asked him to do this for me, and he shows it to everybody. And suddenly there's a couple of people saying, okay, yeah, I'll put a tenner down. And then eventually I get him to do the third one. And, you know, it's the third card. The last one's the ace, and I've told him, don't touch that. But he picks up the third, he puts it down, everybody's giggling.
Yeah.
But they know what the other three cards are. So they know where the ace is. And now I've got the whole room wanting to put £10 down as quick as they can. And some of them had asked me, when you get to three or two cards up, they know it's one of two cards. And some of them then form a little collaboration together. And they say, like, can we join together? Because he can put a tenner on that, and you put a tenner on that, and you're going to win 50 quid. You know, it's a winner. It's a no-brainer. But when you get to, you see three cards, you've got 100% information you need to make a perfect decision here. Right? Now, I argue that it is legal if you have the resources, if you've defined the right question, or what information do you need, if you have the right resources, time being the most difficult one, but sometimes you need some money to commission research or something to do it. If you have those resources, you can get information to just about anything legally that you want. And therefore, you make a decision now that is, the risk has gone out the window because you've looked at what information will reduce risk to zero or to 1%. And you're making now a decision that's 99% chance of being successful, you know?
Yeah, so mostly if I want to make a good decision, I need to have more information and understand what I'm facing. But like nowadays, as you are like going to publish the Substack with the AI, it feels like there are a huge... like a huge movement towards data or data gathering or data-based anything.
Yep.
And there are lots of information out there.
Lots of it. Yeah. Now, this is where people go completely wrong. There's so much data out there. And that's the question people are asking, how much data is out there? These are the wrong questions. What kind of data is out there? That's the wrong question. The question is that and this is the art of great questions. The great question is, what data do I need to make a great decision?
Exactly.
Now, you can get it. Once you know the data you need, you can get it legally pretty much, once you know what you're after.
So there is a huge difference between information and what I need, which is knowledge somehow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there is a difference between knowledge and information.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. I think this is something. So, do you think that this changed since this we have a different type of era at the moment somehow? So we live in an era that is social media driven more. Mm-hmm. We have this kind of AI going on right now, and our motivations maybe got changed somehow. Is it?
Yeah. There's a big risk of dumbing down nations.
Mm.
That's a real worry. We have shortened attention spans. Mm. We're into visuals. Scrolling, is addictive. I have heard that the algorithm used by TikTok in China is very different to the algorithm used by TikTok in the West. Have you come across this?
No.
So I'm told that if you look at TikTok in China, you will see stuff like two young entrepreneurs who've been successful talking about how they grew their business. There'll be stuff about a guy doing Tai Chi, talking why it's so important and showing you exercises to do. You'll meet someone else who's doing good work in the community. Stuff that makes a nation great and society wonderful in nurturing that. Yet that's not shown over in the West. What we see is stupid stuff.
Mm.
Okay, a bit of dancing is nice, but not for an hour and a half or whatever. I think most people should be doing other things. And stupid pranks, smashing eggs on people's heads. They get parents to smash eggs on children's heads. That's psychologically damaging to a child for a parent to do that to them. That's awful stuff. And it's divisive stuff that's out there. It's a polarized stuff. So I think it could be quite damaging what is going out through TikTok and other social media, tell you the truth. But if this is true, and maybe some of your viewers could let us know and send some comments in to you to say it is true or it isn't true, I'm saying I've heard it's true. Maybe somebody could confirm. Is it? Maybe TikTok. Somebody in TikTok could tell us. Is this true? Because if it is true, I'm sorry, Mr. TikTok. You should take your TikTok and put it somewhere. You know?
Yeah, I know what I mean. But as a sportsman yourself, now you have this kind of argument that instead of having a social media, instead of we are somehow spend most of our times in social media and trying to brand ourselves somehow, but maybe sports can save us or have an impact to the world.
Yes, yes, it can. You know, the purpose of the Olympics, Olympism, it's called Olympism. I did a TED talk on can sportsmanship save the world? So if you Google Pierre Smith in TED, you'll find it. And yeah, there's a lot of evidence that sportsmanship, honor, friendship, nobility, respect, you know, these are great virtues and should be nurtured and should be taught to everybody and reminded. And when we show kids it, they love it. There's lots of examples of countries at war. You know, the original Olympics, actually, they used to put out, the Greeks used to put a message out, the ancient Olympics, they put a message out and they'd ask any warring nations or warring territories to suspend war to allow a safe passage through for athletes that were coming from different corners of the world. And as you know, the Olympics was a celebration. Sport was one part of it, but it was a celebration of art and culture and education as well. So, you know, in the 1950 Olympics in London was the last gold medal to be issued for literature, you know, and architecture. They gave medals for architecture. These are the competition. But it was the purpose of the Olympics was to strengthen an individual in mind and body, number one. And number two is to make friends with people from other nations. Mm. You know, this is beautiful stuff. This is what the world desperately needs right now. So the original principles are more than ever valid. I'm working with a group called the World Diversity Games. Mm. I can't say too much more about it, but it's going to happen next year. Watch out. There will be major headlines. This will be big. It'll be in America. It'll be very big. And I'm involved in that, but I'm not allowed to talk about it till all the dots, the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. But it's because diversity and games, and we like to play, and sometimes we forget to play. And we've got to drag people away from screens. You know, gaming, I think, is not good to be stuck at a screen for the whole weekend, as a lot of kids are. Let's get them out. Let's get them playing sport if we can, and let them enjoy the I love seeing people playing teams, any team sport. You know, going to a gym is fine, but it's solo and it's looking at yourself in a mirror. You know, it's not communicating with other people. So let's get more team sports going.
I remember you talked a lot about examples that happened in the Olympics, even more in the football championship, somehow the world championship. How do you frame this, that this could actually, let's say, maybe solve a conflict or something?
You have North and South Korea playing table tennis and shaking hands with each other and taking photographs and, you know, on the podium and that kind of thing. But here's a little story, if I may. One that caught my eye some years ago. It was the, which Olympic was it? Let me just think for a second. It was America. Well, anyway, America were drawn in the same group as Iran. And as they did it on television, and they pulled the name out, they went, USA. And everybody goes, ooh. They pull out Iran. Everyone, oh my God, you know, because these guys were saying terrible things about the American embassy had just been burnt. So things weren't good. And they thought this will be a disaster. Now, when the two teams arrived into the World Cup, somebody made an arrangement that the teams would meet the night before and have dinner together because of the high profile nature of the game. And they agreed, actually it was a little time before that, because they agreed that they would line up during the national anthems, and when they walked down and shake hands, they would give each other a gift.
Wow.
Yeah. And they did. And so, you know, the word was they're about to go to war, Iran and America. The Americans are about to bomb them, and the two teams are playing each other. And they displayed, they had dinner together the night before, you know, in broken English, exchanging stories, as you do when you're traveling on tour playing sport. And they got on like a house on fire. They got it really well together. They went out the next day. They exchanged the gifts to each other, which is really beautiful. And every time an American fell down, you know, to a tackle or whatever, a hand would go out from an Iranian, pick him up. Every time an Iranian went down, they said they'd do this, and they did it. And the world saw it. It was wonderful. And they both won. But I don't know if it's ever happened before. Both teams won. Not an individual team or an individual. There is the fair play medal. Both those nations won the fair play medal that year. And the bombs didn't go off. Now, I don't know if you could, well, at any rate. Yeah. But it's one of the moments when we conquer beyond politics. You know, when people demonstrate, this time through sport, humanity and the decency of friendship, the importance of friendship and the importance of diversity. You know, you're an Arab, I'm an Irish guy. I thoroughly enjoy our company together. I'm so pleased we've got this chance to have this chat. And that's a great thing. You know, we're both learning from each other and we're diverse, we're different, and it's wonderful. I don't want this ever to stop, but there's people that do want it to stop for power reasons. And AI has a dirty and dark role to play in that, as does social media, sadly. So sport is a wonderful thing. It can bring people together. And the Olympics and football, the beautiful game, and the World Diversity Games, which you'll see next year. Watch out for that. You're getting 6 months advance notice that nobody else has. We've made no releases to nobody. So you're the first people to hear about this.
That's great.
Yeah.
So how do you think the future of marketing, like you are writing a book about AI now, right now, yeah. And
well, it's not about, it's applying integrating AI into the Substack framework.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So and also I feel that this kind of framework, the Substack framework, I can apply it to myself. Even.
Yeah,
like even for my personal growth.
Yes, people have used it for weddings. They use it for personal growth plans. Exactly. It can be used for anything. Yeah,
yeah. But on the other hand, how do you see the future of marketing itself? Because I have this kind of integration between like companies or like products and even people. So people are trying to brand themselves at this moment,
yep,
and trying to use even the usual tactics of marketing for themselves on the social media. So they want to become more influencers somehow. And I feel this is a new currency. So everyone is like being judged or being valued somehow by how many people that are following him and how much he exists on the internet. If you can Google someone's name, okay, what he can be brought up. But anyways, I mean, so it feels that there is a huge, I don't know, it's I can say this word, but it's liquidity between like companies or something that is used to be a brand itself or rigid, something that is rigid and run by people and people themselves because of maybe social media, because of how we perceive stuff at the moment, because there are this kind of line, differentiated lines are vanished somehow. So how do you see the future?
The future of AI or marketing? No, or
marketing itself.
The future of marketing. More and more AI, definitely.
More AI.
Yeah, more and more AI, even though it has limitations. You know, we could all end up working 3 day weeks. Wouldn't that be nice? You know, if you didn't take a big cut in your salary, but you're doing a better job because you're using AI, creating maybe other jobs elsewhere. So the future of marketing, I hope certain markets won't turn into monopolies or duopolies or whatever, you know, a small number of kind of big boys ruling everything. It's important that small businesses survive as well. So the world of marketing, we will do more. There's nothing too new in virtual reality. I mean, I launched Northern Ireland's first creative hub in Belfast in the shipyard where they made the Titanic. It's now a business venue. But that was 2004, so that's 20 years ago, mm-hmm. we launched there and we did 300 people in that building, but we had 60 avatars in Second Life, you know, the virtual world that was available back then. It's still mm-hmm. around, but it's not that big now. But I had the Minister for Enterprise appearing in Second Life in a separate venue that we had. So I walked off screen on stage. I said, we've got a parallel thing going on to the audience and it's in the virtual world of Second Life. And we showed the screen and we decked out the whole building, this virtual building, with the branding of creativity with an eight in the middle of it, creative. So I walk off stage and my avatar walks on stage, says, hi, we're back again. And there's a live audience here of all these people. And I said, now we've got a surprise for you. The Minister for Enterprise, Nigel Dodd, and he comes across. I written in the script that he flies in, but he refused to do that. Mm-hmm. He walked in and then he delivers his speech, which I wrote for him. And then he says, look, I've got to go back to Westminster. Paul will take any questions. And so he goes off and then I take a few questions from people there. And then I bump into the guy who's in a virtual world, who's doing the DJ for the real world event. I said, what are you doing here? You should be back in the real world. He said, oh my God, is that the time? Let's go. Our two avatars turn into humans and walk back on stage. Now that was happened 20 years ago. So I don't get overexcited about virtual reality. It's been around for a while. We saw some of it demonstrated today, which was quite interesting. There are parallel markets. It will grow, I do believe. You know, it's not going to take over the world or anything like that. It's some people will spend time there. That's fine. And it's great for people who may be disabled and so on. They can have full functionality in those environments. So that'd be good. IoT, I think, will grow significantly. Yeah. The Internet of Things, AI will grow most definitely. VR will grow, but I don't think it's going to change the world of marketing completely. We are seeing small changes like car distributors, upmarket electronic vehicles. You don't have to go to a car distributor. Mm. You'll find a small boutique in a shopping mall or an upmarket area where you put on your virtual gear and you will take a virtual drive. And you'll have a steering wheel to hold on to and brakes and all the rest of it. That's happening already in California. And we'll see a lot more of that. So you'll see a bit more integration. So all the IoT, the VR, the AR, you name it, AI, we'll see more of that, there's no doubt. That will be used more and more. I don't think it's going to blow us all away, but we will see more of it.
Yeah, but I have this kind of idea when we rely a lot on AI and the same data that we have. So we will be copying yep. ourselves.
Yes, we call it homogeneity. Okay. When content is all homogenized, it's all the same. Yeah. So you're using the same prompts, you get the same stuff. And then that same stuff goes out into the internet and then is used to scrape up yes. and be fed back in next time. Eventually you get first of all, you get duplicated content, which you'd probably be penalized by Google for having duplicate content. They don't like that. And you will not be differentiated with your customer. So that's a problem. And if it continues, it becomes even more biased because AI will be looking for patterns and will tend to pick the most common to get a simpler pattern, and it'll exclude the diverse ones. So we'll lose diversity and we'll get more common to the point where the thing can collapse. I've got a great cartoon. I've just bought the license from this cartoonist in America who did a really clever piece showing mad cow disease. Mm-mm. Was similar to model collapse. So mad cow occurred because they fed dead cows to living yeah. cows, and out came this strain that killed the humans, the damage as well. Yeah. And then, so with data that's been created by AI, which is biased probably, is going into, so less lower quality data is going out there and it's included in the data that's been fed into the next question that's asked. So you eventually get to a point where the whole model sort of collapses in a heap. They've wow. done an interesting experiment, I think it's Cambridge, with dogs, and Labradors are the most common type. And so if you ask for a picture, you just get a Labrador after a while. You can't get any of the other dogs. And that gets worse and worse and worse to the point where eventually you get a dog with two heads. I don't understand that last bit, but that is true model collapse. So duplicate content, model collapse, these are problems. But yeah, there's many disadvantages of AI, 7 or 8 that we've talked through earlier today, and the 7 or 8 advantages to AI. So it's got its pros and cons, but we need to be aware of both of them. And there will be disasters. You know Bard, when it launched, you know, they lost 100 billion on that launch day because they had an hallucination, an error, factual error. So, you know, there is goofy stuff. Some people are going to get burnt by just being casual with AI and just letting it go. I'm in discussion with a company, a university in England, who claim that you don't need all the analysis stuff that us marketers do because this thing will do it all for you. And I said, well, it doesn't do it very well. And he says, no, but we put it through 8 different systems and in 2 years' time it will be working and it will be, you'll never have to do a portal analysis again. Mm. It'll just scrape the data and it'll tell you what strategy to do. I said, I believe it when I see it. Now, there's no doubt AI will become cleverer and cleverer and cleverer. And there will be some collateral damage done along the way from some of the errors it'll spit out. But they are convinced that it will take over the making of strategy for marketers. I'm not convinced. I'll wait and see.
Do you think AI will replace creativity?
Well, there's a different way of looking at that. You can use AI to be even more creative.
Mm. How is that?
You can build randomness into it. Mm. So you could ask it to ideate, generate ideas for a new product, and you give it the type of products you're in, the type of market you're in, your competition, all that, and say, now, I want you to do a word association experiment to generate concepts of ideas for new products. And you use word association techniques, you know, so pick out 2 random words from a dictionary or ask it to randomly pick 5 letters or randomly pick 5 numbers and each number equates to a letter. And then you find a word randomly that associates that and then put 2 human random notes in there and then do those exercises like random walk. So I say the word hole and then you've got to say anything comes to your mind. So we did this for rally bicycles, helmets, where they're trying to sell more light fittings for the bicycles. So this girl said hole, somebody said dark hole, somebody said coal miners, bingo. We got our first idea. It's coal miners' helmets. They've got torches in them, haven't they? So that could be a very simple solution to motor. That was one of 50 ideas we generated manually, but you can do that with AI by training it to do just that again. So it can be creative. You can also ask it to produce ideas and then say, I want you to extend this. This is not bad, but I want you to make it even more radical or more outside the box or more ridiculous or more funny or more blue or more black. And you can push it.
Yeah.
To be more creative.
Yeah, I feel that what you are saying is I can use AI to have a brainstorming session with them.
Yeah, and the next step in new product development is assessment of all the ideas and narrowing them down to the better ones. So the analysis of that, you can put the scores in and the weights of the scores of the criteria and it'll go off and do it. And then it can go further than that. It can then help you build the prototypes and it can go further again. It can help you test them. You know, with synthetic data and synthetic people, how would they react to this? You are going into a room full of 25 people, Mr. Bot. You're introducing this new cheese. What are their reactions? Their ages are this or that. Yeah. Now, it doesn't give you perfect true information, but it gives you another angle. So any stage can be helped. It needs to be checked by humans, but it can be helped by AI.
I think it's becoming more important to have maybe frameworks also for AI. Yeah. So, I mean, this kind of relationship, how I can use AI.
Yeah.
So it's a good idea to have to try to implement SoStack through AI.
And we need regulations though. We need AI. Exactly. To be regulated. Yeah. Of course. That's really, really important.
Of course. Like PR Smith. Don't you get tired of being the marketing guru around the world?
I'm not a marketing guru. Okay. You know, I've developed a clever enough planning framework that's easily memorable and perfectly logical and does give a reassuring sense of order. That's taken quite a lot of work. People like it. That's really nice. I do get a buzz from people. I've got so many stories coming to me today. One guy told me, he's from a marketing agency, and he said, when we adopted SoStack, he said, I've got the proof. He said, it's actually doubled our conversion rate of pitches. When we use in pitches, we've gone from 12%, he said, to 25% success rate with pitches. And that's really pleasing to hear. And all those little companies that we've helped break into the American market, 300 companies, that gives me so much pleasure. So I don't know about guru, but I do get savage pleasure from stories of people telling me that how it's changed their life, their career, their job, their business. I love hearing those stories, particularly if they're small and they're bold and they're having a go. You know, I love it. I met this lady last night. She's got doing Egyptian gowns.
Yeah.
She's got a chance with Harrods. So I was talking to her very carefully about Harrods, you know, to act now. Don't wait a month on this one. She was kind of waiting until she has her full catalogue ready. She said, no, put a catalogue of 10 items, get it to them and tell them you're working on the rest, you know, get the dialogue going, the door's open, it won't be open for long. So I love seeing small individuals getting up, and I mean, they're the future of the economy, small businesses, aren't they, really? It's not the multinationals, it's the small ones coming through. So that gives me great, immense pleasure. And if people call me a guru, that's fine. I don't take myself that seriously. As I say, yeah, you're never too old to be a child, you know.
But I mean, that's what like ChatGPT is talking about you.
Yeah, but wrongly, Gemini is referring to Sustack incorrectly and saying it's weak at this and that. So that needs to be fixed. I don't want that kind of publicity. I don't want that kind of stuff being said about it. So I'll have to fix that. I will.
Yeah, I think the framework is really good, and it can be implemented in so many ways.
Yes.
And not just in marketing.
Yes.
And what I figured out throughout our conversation is can even use it throughout my personal stuff.
Yes, you can. Yeah.
And it would work perfectly. And it's very easy.
And if anybody wants to apply to themselves, just go to sustack.org. Mm-hmm. There's a 3-minute video there that runs through this, exactly what I've said. And it is as simple as that. Sustack.org, sustac.org. And there's a 3-minute video that'll help people if they want to use it for themselves.
Yeah, thank you for for making this framework, and it's actually helping people outside there, and even helping me. I am a marketer, and I would love to have it always in my side, because I will ditch all the frameworks that I'm using and just have a very simple one that is rememberable.
Yeah,
it's great. And also, how do you like Cairo?
I love it.
Okay.
It's a crazy place.
Is it your first time?
No, my third trip. I love it. I really love it. I played 31, which is like back. It's a backgammon, essentially, isn't it? On the street with an old guy, and his son was sitting there. It was like at 10, 11 o'clock at night. And his 10-year-old son was out. You know, that's in itself is amazing. But he was so kind and so nice and so patient explaining to me. And it was great fun. And I really enjoyed that. That was so cool. Mm. And I had my fruit drink made from the cane. That was interesting as well. But I did something very stupid and silly. The lady I was with is a professor from the German university in Cairo. And she's an expert in AI. And in fact, she does my, you know, I didn't mention this to you. Tomorrow, Friday, at 3 o'clock your time, Cairo time, I do a 30-minute talk every week about AI innovation and ethics.
That's on LinkedIn, huh?
Yeah, it's on LinkedIn. Okay. Yeah, on my LinkedIn page. And you'll only find me if you put in Paul Smith plus PR Smith, because I've had to change my name because they couldn't validate me because my passport says different. But anyways, so Dr. Sarah is one of three. So there's Sarah in Cairo, me in London, and my friend Reggie in Texas. Mm. And we discuss AI every week. And we post the topics we talked and the links to them on my blog, piersmith.org/blog. And it's really good. You don't have to sign anything. You don't have to sign up for nothing. There's no registration. It's free. Just pop in, sit in and enjoy it and tell your friends and come. You're all like, it's only a small group, only a half dozen people, but everybody's welcome. I've just lost my track. Why am I telling you this? It's Cairo. So Dr. Sarah took me very kindly, a little walk. I said, she said, you can't come to Cairo and we can't meet up. We've been working together for a couple of years. It's ridiculous. I said, well, look, I hope you don't think this is rude, but I'm prepping. I've got to do this presentation for today. And it's, you know, I really do like to get it right. And it went very well, actually. But it wouldn't have if I didn't devote that extra time to really making it right. I said, look, you know, maybe we could just have a coffee for 30 minutes. Would that be? I hope that's not too rude. She said, no, that's fine. Or would you prefer just go for a walk by the river? I said, fantastic. Oh, wow. So in fact, we ended up walking two and a half hours. But in that, I got to learn about crossing the road in Cairo.
Crossing road in Cairo, wow.
I loved it. I did that for about 40 minutes. Back across the road, back just, but nobody was angry with me. There was like, zoom. Oh my God, that was fun. Yeah.
It's so dangerous.
Truck, a bus going,
yeah, but like nothing happens. It's so weird.
I can't. People walked in front of our car on the way down here tonight. They didn't even look. Yeah. They didn't even look, they just walked.
Yeah.
Oh, it's amazing. Amazing. I love Cairo. Yeah.
I'm really happy that I had you today.
Yeah, thank Paul. You.
And I think this is this episode was really exciting for me.
Oh, good.
As I look up to you so much.
Well, I look up to you. This is an intriguing conversation we've had. I really mean that. I've never had a chat like this. It's fascinating. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. And thank you for being here in the classroom and for in Cairo. And also, I think we, like now, we have kosher, I think, outside.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yes. I think it's time to eat.
Excellent. Good idea. Thank you very much. Cheers.